Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and every week the team and I will be bringing you an exciting mix of discussion, interviews and stories. This week we discuss Alex Salmond, the spending review and possible tax hikes, talk about the way suicide is reported with NS blogger Willard Foxton and novelist Rebecca Waite, hear about NS Assistant Editor Daniel Trilling's recent reporting trip to Greece, listen to Sophie Elmhurst and pop critic Kate Mossman talk about Rihanna. Meanwhile, Alex Hearn and I will talk about the crowdfunding platform Kickstarter. Our cover story this week is an interview with Alex Salmond, leader of the Scottish National Party. I'm joined by Raphael Baer, our political editor, and George Eaton, the editor of The Staggers, to talk a little bit about it. Raph, first of all, in this interview, Alex Salmond talks about a jobs guarantee for young people. He doesn't actually mention how he would cost that, and I wonder what your thoughts were about how feasible it is as a policy.
Well, the first thing to say about that is it's also a Labour policy. Salmond says he would sort of write it into a Scottish constitution, Labour don't. But the essential point is that you mobilise the power of government and the state to do does what it says on tin, guarantee people a job. The question that people always sort of throw back at that, and the one that Labour have already found on the doorstep, people saying is, well, how? I don't believe it. How can you just make these jobs? And the answer appears to be, George, you might know more about this than me, you essentially recruit business into this process and you get enterprises, companies to sign up to the scheme. Government finds a mechanism for subsidising job creation directly with employers. Employers sign up to it because they want apprentices and they want to be seen to be helpful. And Labour say they've had a good response to this. I'm sure Salmond wouldn't have announced it if he hadn't found at least enough potential uptake to make it sound feasible. But voters are very sceptical about it, that has to be said.
And George, is this part of a larger attempt? We've seen a lot of appeals to pensioners, you know, Cameron protecting all the pension benefits. Is there now an acknowledgement that actually young people are being slightly stiffed by a lot of policies and there need to be specific policies aimed at them?
I think so. Youth unemployment is still 20-21%. It's not much below a million across the UK. Obviously, Labour have opened up that debate about pensioner benefits with the winter fuel allowance, which only saves 100 million, but symbolically was very important. And they've said now that they'd include pension spending in their welfare cap. And so I also think there's an acknowledgement that you're not going to be able to make, you know, all the savings you want through cuts. And one of the conspicuous areas of the budget that hasn't been touched is pensioner benefits.
So you wrote a blog saying essentially this, that whoever wins the next election is not going to be able to achieve deficit reduction entirely through cuts. So yeah. What do you think are the likely areas that we'll see tax rises?
Well, the Tories, before the last election, said we have no plans to raise VAT. First thing they did, put VAT up to 20%. VAT is always an obvious candidate to increase because it's very easy to collect. Labour will...
And presumably people don't blame the government for the fact that their shampoo or their, you know, bread or whatever is slightly more expensive.
Absolutely, yes. Income tax is a much more sort of politically sensitive tax. Labour, I'm sure, will
reinstate... I don't think you can put VAT on bread, can you?
No, there's a long, complicated... I'm sure okay, we'll have letters, but yeah. It'll be the Jaffa cake question all over again. But you know what I mean, on household goods. Yeah.
Labour, I'm sure, will reinstate the 50p rate. They'll introduce some kind of mansion tax. But the problem is... Although those taxes are politically useful, they don't raise much money because they don't affect many people. So the big question for Labour and the Tories is, look, the IFS, the Resolution Foundation, have said, actually, if you don't introduce any more welfare cuts or tax rises, departmental spending is going to have to be cut 50% faster than it's being cut at the moment. And of course, the longer you cut, the harder the cuts get to make. And so how are you going to fill the hole?
Yeah, the interesting, if you talk to sort of what former chancellors have said many times, is, look, there's only two ways to really raise big fat sums of money, and that's VAT and the basic rate of income tax. VAT has already gone up. essentially ever since the sort of early 90s, putting even a penny on the basic rate of income tax is a massive taboo issue. But actually, it raises a lot of money. And the interesting thing is, at what point does someone dare to say, look, if you want to all be in it together, put a penny on the basic rate? But we're so far away from even having that conversation.
And you've written in your column this week, Raf, about departmental budgets and the fact that in 2010 they were offering up sacrificial lambs of huge amounts of money, and now every Osborne is having to claw every penny away from them.
Yeah, the contrast is remarkable. I think essentially a lot of particularly conservative incoming ministers in 2010. Thought it would be easier than this. I mean, first of all, there was an ideological presumption that you sort of have a short, sharp shock of cuts, and then the economy is sort of released from the dead hand of the state, and enterprise and investment do the rest, and growth comes back quite quickly. We know that that simply didn't happen for all sorts of reasons. But also, there was a sort of an ideological conviction that it was a sort of a morally right thing to do to rein in spending. And then once you've been in your department for a while and you've felt a bit of political heat from, for example, there being fewer police officers or not being able to fight wars in the case of the Ministry of Defence, you get a little bit bolshier about your budget. And so the point I was making in the column, or one of the points, is that increasingly sort of everyone in politics is realizing that this isn't just a couple of years of pain. This is a good decade or more of reimagining what government can do, what the state can do. And as all politicians, left and right, they get elected to pull levers in a state system. And if that's going to be a rusty, broken, shrunken state system, it's slightly less appealing as a prospect. And the idea that actually watching your rivals have a go at it and mess it up starts to acquire a certain kind of luster.
And to bring it back around to the Salmon interview, the other thing he says is that, the bedroom tax could be the new poll tax. He thinks that it's a vastly unfair, unpopular tax. Where are Labour on that?
Well, this is very interesting. One of the things that particularly Labour MPs on the left have said to me is that they were really getting a bit of momentum behind their bedroom tax campaign, and people understood it. The language was working. The Tories looked ridiculous when they tried to call it a spare room subsidy. It hadn't been thought through, it hadn't been costed properly. It was a disaster, and their fist was starting to connect with Tory jaw on this. And then when asked the question, would you repeal it? And having to give the answer, well, it's a bit early to say, we're not sure about that, it's going to be a very tight fiscal settlement in 2015. Then all the life went out of it. Alex Salmond clearly understood this, and he thought, you went halfway, you didn't have the guts, tell you what, we'll have that piece of political pie, thank you very much. Gobble, gobble, gobble. And he's not afraid of a bit of pie, famously.
And on that note, I'll say thank you to George and Raf. This week, the youth magazine Vice attracted an enormous amount of controversy for a fashion spread based around the idea of female writers who had committed suicide. It graphically demonstrated the author's methods of committing suicide. I'm joined by the novelist Rebecca Waite, author of The View on the Way Down, and our blogger and Telegraph's bloggers, Willard Foxton, to talk about the issue. So, first of all, Rebecca, you wrote about this piece for the New Statesman website. What was your reaction on seeing the pictures?
I think disbelief at first and then anger, because it is so dangerous, and I'm not sure everyone appreciates that. Certainly Vice don't seem to have appreciated that. I mean, I hope in a way that they didn't understand that when they did the pictures. Mainly shock at how they glamorised the act of suicide. Very beautiful women, beautiful clothes, looking very kind of serene as they went to meet their ends, which can have a huge impact in how suicide is viewed as this kind of dramatic or poetic gesture, whereas actually, in context, it's often the end of a very harrowing struggle with depression, has huge ramifications for the family. The individual is not going to be remembered as this kind of person who waded beautifully into a river. They're just going to be dead and gone.
And one of the things that the Samaritan's guidelines say is that if you depict suicide creatively in television, for example, if you show a painkiller overdose, you don't show somebody who then bounds back and is fine again. You show the
absolutely
harrowing problem of liver failure.
Yeah.
And Willard, you've written about suicide. Your father committed suicide. And how do you feel? Where are we with how it's represented in the media?
Well, talking about the Vice brand, I certainly didn't want to go out and buy my girlfriend a Fendi cardigan immediately afterwards. I couldn't believe that the fashion brands agreed to do that shoot. But I suppose the way I think it is in the media is, I wrote a piece about responsible reporting for suicide, and I've got this awful feeling that every 3 weeks it's going to be repeated back. I'm going to have to retweet it over and over and over again, because it is consistently reported badly, and not just by the local press, but by national newspapers, by by TV news outlets. It's one of those topics that over and over and over again is reported incredibly badly.
And what are the kind of things that you're talking about there?
Well, specifically, things like they will ascribe a cause, a specific cause to suicide. So they'll take the last thing, or they'll take the justification that was put in a suicide note and say, that is the be-all and end-all, that is the why of what happened. And it's very tempting to do that, because it creates a very nice narrative, you know. So-and-so's benefits were cut, and then they killed themselves. Although, in actual fact, all the evidence we have about suicide is things are much more complicated than that. And it, as you said, it tends to be the end of a process, a very long process of depression and things breaking down and people cutting off links to support groups, family, friends, all the rest of it, and then suicide's the final act.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you about, because we have seen, as you say, a rash of stories about this government's policies are driving people to the edge and that narrative. Do you think that though that is irresponsible reporting?
I think it's quite difficult. I think I clocked the first time I saw a story saying this government will cause suicide, and it was 3 weeks after the general election. And there has been a consistent narrative through the press that this government's policies will cause suicide. And there's been a consistent message when there have been suicides that have been linked to benefit cuts that this is not only that this is the government's fault, but this is in some ways, a powerful act, that this is making people sit up and take notice. And I think that sends an incredibly irresponsible message. Firstly, because I don't think Downing Street is listening. And secondly, because even if they were listening, I think it's incredibly irresponsible to incentivise that and say that this is somehow brave and noble and it's people taking a stand, and also that it is the rational response to having your benefits cut, that it is to kill yourself. And that, I feel, is a message that has gone far and wide through the media.
Well, we know that, for example, with self-immolations, that, you know, because the first one attracted such enormous media coverage, it became the thing, you know, it became a sort of almost a trend of that was the way that people showed their disgust with a policy. Rebecca, I'm interested because you tackled this issue in your novel, and I understand that you worked with the Samaritans on that.
Well, my mum's a Samaritan, and so I've had that in the background for many years. And the novel's also based on my own experience of depression as a teenager, so I felt, coming at it from both those angles, I had quite a good understanding of someone's sensitivities involved in the complexities of suicide. And I was determined, really, to portray the suicide in the novel as something that's very grim, very harrowing, very bleak, and not remotely glamorous, and not a kind of an act of defiance, not something that achieves anything or has an effect that continues, except to obviously cause huge trauma to the family. And I think something that was true for me as a teenager when I was depressed and perhaps thinking about suicide, and might be true of other people, is that you don't always fully comprehend that death is forever. I know it sounds a strange thing to say, but often the way suicide's reported, you see, you know, you hear that the young person's killed themselves, and then there's all the messages reported from their friends, the outpouring of grief, the pictures of people weeping at the funeral, and I think that can seem quite appealing in some ways. And you don't fully realise that once you kill yourself, you're actually gone, you're dead, you don't see any
that. That's a teenage sense of you'll miss me, you'll realise what
I'm
what.
Yeah, it doesn't achieve anything. And so I think that's the danger in suicide reporting, that the person gets kind of eulogised afterwards. And that's something that the Samaritans counsel people not to do, obviously, in reporting.
And Willard, how do you think that, I mean, what are things that you would never like to see again? And what are practical steps that media could take to report suicide better?
Well, it's a lot of it is about the language that's used. So I think, for example, the Samaritans don't like terms like committing suicide.
I know, and I find that very hard to get.
I was just thinking myself as I was saying it, for whether I was using that term, because, yeah.
They say that it's because it's no longer a crime, they don't want to do that. And they don't like the phrase successful suicide attempt, because that implies that that's a kind of a good outcome from that.
I agree. A lot of it's about the language you use, but when you actually think about the power that certain words have, and we're talking about the way this is glamorised and the way that this is seen and the way that vulnerable people will read this, because that's what this is all about. It's not about you or I reading that. It's about someone who is at their lowest ebb reading that article and going, well, that makes sense. I'm in the same position as that person. This is a good way out. This person's been eulogised. And it's that kind of... The thing I really hate when I read suicide reporting is convenient narrative outcomes. This happened, and then the direct result of this one thing happening was the suicide. So I think people should try to avoid, and you know, try to avoid saying things like, this is why the suicide happened. People should always make it a clear point that it is complicated, it is the end of a process of depression. And people should really think about the impact their writing might have on other people. I think it's so easy when people are on deadline, and you've just been told it's, you know, it's 2 a.m. you're in a newsroom and you've just been told cover this suicide in Grimsby, and it's very easy to the other thing about it is when suicide gets into the press, because most suicides aren't reported, the vast bulk just aren't reported because they're not news. And I think when suicide gets into the press, we were talking about the way people are memorialized, but people, when they see suicide in the press, a lot of very vulnerable people think, well, if I die, it will be the only way I can have a voice. This is the only way I can propel myself and my problems into the news. And so much of I mean, people say things like, oh, suicide is a cry for help. And in some ways, a suicide, you know, trying to kill yourself is a cry for help. It's saying, I desperately need someone to listen to me. And I think that when you do run big stories about suicide, it can be very, very responsible. I remember talking to a group of academics who were saying, I was there to meet them and talk about ways in which scientists could better engage with the media. And they started talking to me about suicide reporting. And until I had done that, I hadn't realised just how irresponsible the coverage was, because they just kept on bringing example after example after example after example of ways in which coverage in practically every national newspaper in the past year have been incredibly irresponsible, and it's just a constant problem.
I think that's the thing to stress, because I mean, I wrote about the Vice thing for The Guardian, and I got quite a lot of flack from it from people from Vice who said, well, we do lots of great stuff as well, and I thought it was true. But I think that's probably not emphasised enough, the fact that The Guardian this year ran the suicide note of the nurse who hanged herself after the prank call about the Duchess of Cambridge. The Telegraph put Paris Jackson on the front page when she, you know, she was 15 and she attempted suicide. So it's not, it's not perpetuated by evil tabloids or evil right-wing press. It's everybody still hasn't got to grips with the subject, right? We just still are trying to work out what the way to deal with it is.
I think it's one of those things where slowly, the problem with it is reporting on suicide tends to be the kind of thing that goes to the junior reporter on the late shift. And once you've done it badly once, you get the feedback and you realise. But then it's quite rare that you'll do the same thing again. And I think it's a mistake that a lot of, especially young journalists make, and young journalists on local papers make, because they roll it all together into, it's just another story, and they don't think about the consequences of it.
Thank you very much, Willard and Rebecca. I'm joined by assistant editor Daniel Trilling, who also edits the Austerity in Europe blog on the New Statesman website, to talk about the piece he's written about the Greek town of Yerissos in the magazine. So, yeah, first of all, tell us about when did you go and what did you see?
Okay, so I last visited Greece at the end of April, and I travelled up to northern Greece to this village, in fact, called Yerissos, which is on the Halkidiki Peninsula, which is a very beautiful, quite remote bit of northern Greece. And there have been growing protests there for the last few years over plans to expand gold mining in the area. So that region has always had small-scale mining, but the current plans are to sell off a huge tract of land to a Canadian mining conglomerate, which will then turn a whole mountainside essentially into an open-cast gold mine.
And the level of protest is incredible. So it's a town of, what, 4,000 people, and it started off with 3,000 people taking to the streets.
Yeah, so what they've done, the campaigners there have been able to build this into a huge movement involving thousands of people. They've drawn in people from the surrounding villages. They've also had solidarity protests in, for example, Thessaloniki, which is Greece's second largest city. I think they had 15,000 people out on the streets there quite recently.
And why is this, why is this important? Because, you know, I mean, for those of people who are not familiar with the kind of the politics of Greece and what's happened with austerity policies there, you know, what does this tell us?
Well, it's important because it really underlines how austerity and how the various governments' response to the financial crisis has been to choose a form of economic shock therapy, which in effect is using the crisis as an excuse to push forward even more extreme versions of the neoliberal free market policies that they had wanted to push before the crisis.
So this town was told basically you have to have a gold mine, kind of Greece demands it, it's the only way to get the economy back on its feet.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, the irony is that under the terms of the agreement, I don't think the Greek state is set to make any money out of royalties from the minerals extracted, and yet the government is saying we have to go ahead with this because the economy is in such a state, it will create jobs and the rest of it. And I think it struck a chord with many Greeks across the whole country who see this as symbolic of the way that they feel they've been treated in many other ways. And I mean, what I tried to do in the piece in the magazine is tie this into the wave of protests that have happened in the last week in Greece about the closure of the national broadcaster ERT. So yet again, this was another move justified by the government that, you know, we're
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We want to cut jobs at the broadcaster to meet the targets set by our creditors for cutting civil service jobs. But again, the government has done this in a very heavy-handed way where they ordered the broadcaster to essentially be switched off almost immediately.
So there was this footage of people just sort of going in while they're in the middle of delivering the news show, right, and just kind of switching off monitors.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, you know, Greece is a country that's got quite a turbulent recent history. You know, it was a military dictatorship at the end of the 60s until the mid-70s. And so whenever the government does something direct as that, it raises fears. People get very worried and they get angry, and you can see how reactions develop and turn into protest movements.
And editing the Austerity in Europe blog, which are the countries that you're finding most interesting stories are coming out of at the moment? Because I know we've been talking about Hungary, for example.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the two trends at the moment you can see in Europe are in terms of responses to the crisis and responses to the sort of austerity policies are that either countries are sort of engaged in this slow or not so slow drift rightwards pushed by the rise of kind of populist and far right parties sort of on the political fringes. Hungary is a very good example of that, where not only does it have a quite popular far-right movement that are the third party in parliament. This is Jobbik, but the government itself, run by a party called Fidesz, which used to be seen as centre-right, even Blairite, in fact, has been slowly removing constitutional checks and balances and increasing its own control on the country. So that's one side of the reaction. And then otherwise, I think we've seen increasing amounts of street protests. I think there was a point at the end of last week where there were large street protests happening all at once in Bulgaria, Bosnia, Greece, and then Turkey as well. So that's a whole chunk of southeastern Europe where people are protesting against various wrongs that they see committed by their governments, and that in most cases have a quite clear economic edge of grievance to them.
Thank you very much, Daniel. We'll leave it there.
I'm Sophie Elmhurst, the features editor of The New Statesman, and with me here is Kate Mossman, our pop critic, who not long ago went all the way to Twickenham Stadium to see Rihanna live in concert. Was it your first time seeing
her? No, I'd seen her in the middle of the farcical tour where she was on the jumbo jet going around the world, 7 countries in 7 days with a load of journalists. And that was in November, and that set up an idea that Rihanna was one way, and then the Twickenham Rihanna was very different.
So, yeah, because the tour obviously was this kind of absurd, worldwide, corporate-sponsored...
Yeah, and she sort of disappeared in it. There were people that... We all seemed to know somebody who was on the plane. And the fact was that nobody saw her. There was no FaceTime with Rihanna, which a lot of the journalists were promised. And it became this thing where the journalists created their own story, and it almost looked like having a laugh at the expense of the traditional music media, because at one point an Australian writer just took all his clothes off and ran up and down the aisle of the plane to give people something to write about. And they did. Everyone tweeted about it. And, you know, people were set up to write these 2,000-word pieces when they got back. But, of course, we all knew what was going on in real time, because that's the way technology works. And in the middle of it, she was this kind of faceless character, really, behind these big kind of fly sunglasses, and spent a lot of time in her tent backstage smoking. Everyone knows that she's a big stoner. She's admitted that. She Instagrams herself smoking weed. There was a feeling that, you know, would she actually make it on stage every night? She was sometimes 3 hours late, sometimes four. And it just looked like, as much as it was set up to be a return to the great Led Zeppelin days of the rock and roll tour, it was a disaster for everybody, apart from probably for River Island and HTC, who were her sponsors.
So what? How was Twickenham Rihanna different? What had changed?
Well, there was, for a start, I didn't see any great evidence of sponsorship. There were no mobile phones being lobbed out into the audience at frequent intervals. She was really engaged. She was very, very much in control. She smiled an awful lot and she actually chattered. And when I saw Justin Bieber and his sort of slightly disastrous tour in March, and I was struck by how unable he was to improvise on stage and just think, what mindset is someone in? I know he's young, but come on. To not be able to string a sentence together apart from, have you guys heard my new album? Thinking, you're doing this every night. You must be able to say something about London or about the O2. And Rihanna was very much like that when she was on her jumbo jet tour. And then at Twickenham, she was talking about the fact that her whole family was in the audience. She said, my mum's here, my dad's here, my cousins, they're all here from Barbados. If you want to make my mum cry, count to three and then scream Rihanna. And she got everyone to scream her name. And it was weirdly kind of thrilling moment because, okay, it's massively egotistical and also it's very personal somehow. Because you know that she sort of told Elle magazine that she's terrified of her mum, that her mum had a go at her for posting naked pictures online recently. So she is sort of, she does have a sort of fearsome mother figure. And I thought it was quite nice that she kind of involved the family in the thing. I mean, a lot of reviews of that gig comment on the fact that she was wearing hardly any clothes most of the time. And they even said things like, what must her family think of the fact she's wearing knickers on stage? You're kind of missing the point here, because I'm sure they've seen her pants before.
And in your excellent piece, you compare her to, well, there's Lady Gaga, Taylor Swift, Beyonce, Bieber, as you just mentioned. There is this sort of elite superclass, isn't there, now, of touring pop star, where the kind of huge stadium global tour is now the sort of staple of their lives.
With the solo act at the centre.
But that essentially they have become these sorts of commodities to a certain extent, or these sort of mega brands of their own.
Yeah.
And I wonder how, I mean, there are cases, and you know, I've seen Beyonce live, and you sense even amidst all the fireworks that you're... There's a sort of quite an electrifying human presence there. Mm. But with Rihanna, it does always seem to be a bit more touch and go.
It is, but it's funny how it does come through, because no matter what you put on top of the person, no matter how many trucks you've got backstage, no matter how many sort of flamethrowers and dancers, the personality of the pop star does come out. You know, Lady Gaga has set herself up as this really kitsch kind of public servant. She's really funny. She's like... She'll breathe into her microphone deliberately, and it's really uncomfortable, and it's like, like that. She'll go, I am just here for you. Everything I do for you, kind of thing. And it's all a bit funny, and everyone knows she's having a laugh. And Beyonce does that, but she does it slightly more seriously. It's kind of a real workout on stage.
Yeah.
And Rihanna still manages somehow to look like a very laid-back Barbadian girl who's sort of swaggering around on stage, singing every other line. She's got this guide vocalist on stage. Which I wrote about the piece, I found that really interesting. I mean, it's quite normal to mime these days. But she doesn't even pretend to be singing. And it's actually, in a weird kind of postmodern way, it's quite impressive, because it's saying, this is all about the show. This is all, you know, this is all about what you've come to see me. Yes, this is the human being Rihanna on stage. I'm not going to have to sing all the time, am I, guys? You know, I can do it. And so I think that she does have a certain power in that laid backness, that the same way that Gaga and Beyonce have it in their energy.
And I guess inevitably we can't talk about Rihanna without talking about Chris Brown, which has also been of her own volition, a big part of her sort of narrative in the recent years.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was the obvious domestic abuse incident, but she, as you write about, has to some extent used it in her work anyway. I mean
it happened in 2009, and the album that came out that year, it happened in about March, and she had a record out 6 months later that had lyrics which were directly, I can't remember the example, but directly connected to I think it was like a lyric something like, I know what you did to me was wrong, this is cold case love, all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then she brought out a record in November last year. She's done one a year since her career began when she was 16. And it had a duet with him called Nobody's Business, which was very aggressive, kind of, you know, this is our love, it's nobody else's news. Which is ironic, because obviously she was making it everybody else's news.
Exactly. And encouraging everyone to buy it.
Yes. So it was very uncomfortable, very cynical. There was a sense that she doesn't write her own song. There was a great piece in The New Yorker a few years ago about, the team that creates these R&B hits and how they work with the writer to get some ideas, and then they put the music around them. And they obviously knew that they could sell that image. And at the same time, it makes me sad that she would ever, I don't know, at the time I thought there's this idea that she should be a role model for young people and that she was failing in that duty and going back to the boyfriend. I found that very odd, and I still do, because famous people show all sorts of weird, screwed up, addictive, depressing behaviour all the time.
Mm.
And it's never held up as a bad example to fans. Drug addictions aren't, overdoses aren't, eating disorders. It's always seen as a sad byproduct of your situation, of the fact you live in a very weird world and you're very isolated. And in a way, going back to an abusive relationship or a once abusive relationship might have been a similar kind of addictive behaviour, who knows? And it seemed odd that at the time that everyone was like, she should know better than this.
Yeah.
She's got to show an example to these 14-year-old girls that she's never met. And I did, it's weird, there's a headline on, I think it's Grazia this week, has a picture of her, and the headline is, "I'm one of love's addicts." And I don't know whether she's put this idea out, but that she's kind of got to go into this rehab for love or something.
Yeah.
But you do suspect or wonder if it's all part of...
It is all part of the thing,
quite a clever brand.
Yes, yeah, so...
Well, thank you very much, Kate, on the mystery of Rihanna. We'll leave it there.
Thank you.
I'm joined by our senior young person's internet correspondent, Alex Hearn, to talk about Kickstarter.
I've got a promotion. I'm senior.
Yeah,
now.
You're senior. First of all, who or what is Kickstarter?
Kickstarter is a crowdfunding website, the biggest crowdfunding website in the world. Crowdfunding is this idea of funding usually creative works by asking a lot of people to chip together small amounts of money before the work is made to fund the creation of it.
So the way it happens is that you're asked to pledge a certain amount of money, you get rewards for depending on how much you do it, and you only have to pay if everyone else also chips in, right?
Yeah, and that was Kickstarter's big innovation. The idea, obviously, of using a lot of small donations has existed for quite a long time. Kickstarter's thing is coming along and letting people ask for a certain amount of money and then promise that you will not be charged unless everyone gives the full amount, which is really good, because if you want to make an album, and it costs £8,000 to rent the studio, and you're given £4,000, you're in a terrible situation because you owe people something, they've given you money, but you don't actually have enough to make what you promised. Kickstarter solved that with relatively ingenious use of Amazon's payment system. It's a Web 3.0, 4.0, it's an internet success.
17.9. So it all sounds brilliant. What's the problem?
The thing is that Kickstarter, the site, has grown in ways that Kickstarter, the company, might not be entirely comfortable with and don't seem to be very comfortable with. A few of the biggest successes early on were for things which were done in the site's technology section, which is supposed to be a place for people to gain money to sort of release canny new innovations. Actually, it was people basically getting seed capital to start up Silicon Valley companies. So one of the biggest things in the early days of it was something called the Pebble Watch, which is a Bluetooth watch with an e-ink display that hooks up to your iPhone and shows incoming calls and what's playing, all this. They got millions of dollars, but they got it basically by asking people for money to help them set up their company. They then delivered the watch late. They did a lot of it through selling bundles to shops that were going to sell, so you could buy 100 watches in one pack. And Kickstarter doesn't really seem very comfortable with being in that position. If you look at their actions since the Pebble Watch took off, they've made it a lot harder for companies to sell based on an idea only.
Mm.
Instead, they want you to sit down and actually say, this is what I need the money for, this is what I'm going to make, and the money will fund the creation of that. It will not fund me starting a business.
So the other big criticism, as I understand it, is people who could have gotten the money by other ways. So Zach Braff, raising for a film, and Zosia, I believe it's pronounced Mamet, who wanted to make an album with her sister just, for kicks. And she's already a very successful actress, and her dad is a very successful playwright.
This is an interesting thing about the company, because what you don't hear is the failures. Melissa Joan Hart, Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Or Melissa Explains It All for the slightly older crowd.
Wasn't it Clarissa?
Yes, Clarissa.
Clarissa.
Oh, so what, that's how
Melissa
old I am.
Playing Clarissa.
Yep.
She tried to raise money to do a film, and she bombed. She completely failed. Big famous people can do very well. Amanda Palmer is another example. The Veronica Mars movie is yet another example. But they still have to be people with very engaged fan bases.
Will Wheaton could basically
clear
build a giant yacht and sail it. So this is the guy who was Wesley Crusher in Star Trek, who is a kind of nerd icon.
Exactly. I mean, Helen, you could probably raise a fair amount if you came up with a half-decent idea. Because that's what 30,000 Twitter followers and an engaged audience
does.
Be
right back, building my Palace of Solitude out of diamonds and crystals, yeah.
But the thing is, there's the worry that it will choke out small people on Kickstarter. That if Kickstarter becomes a place for Zach Braff to raise $3.5 million to make a sequel to a film that had a general release in cinemas worldwide, that it will be a lot harder for the person.
It wasn't a great film, though, was it? This is Garden State, wasn't it? Which is him and basically Natalie Portman wearing a little helmet
I liked it, but I was a literal child when it came out.
This is so horrifying about these conversations with you. And actually, one of the things that we've seen is that they're having the problem that so many platform companies that are also sort of media companies are having. So there's been this guy from Reddit who has wanted to kickstart for a pickup artist manual, which is basically tells you how to pick up women, in which he says things like, don't take no for an answer. Be dominant. Don't ask for permission first. Women like a man who's strong and in charge.
Her hair if she's like, just loads of really horrible advice. But the problem is that this advice was given on a snippet, what he described in the Kickstarter, of snippets of the books that have been posted on Reddit. And you could go and read little extracts from the chapters. But it was posted on Reddit. And people only sort of made the connection, people outside of the Reddit, quote-unquote, seduction community, which is horrible, only made the connection with a few hours to go. And Kickstarter's since reviewed
this. So it's funded?
It's funded. It got $16,000 to publish this book. And Kickstarter's since reviewed it and gone, look, he didn't say this on our site. He linked to a thing that linked to it, but we can't police everything in that way. And it's a problem for them. They're damned either way, because either they take on the role of not only researching what people actually tell them, but starting to Google the names of submitters and find what they've done elsewhere, or they're going to have other things like this. You know, it's perfectly possible to imagine Tommy Robinson going on and kickstarting a book on how to be a great EDL member, where the Kickstarter description is perfectly, blasé.
Be patriotic, have a few England flags,
but
by
then
a British bulldog.
You click through and you find that he's obviously planning to put horrible crap in it.
And I think, isn't this something that we see over and over again with internet companies? We've got to a stage now where we have, I think you mentioned Facebook and the problems that it's had with these sort of pro-rape pages, Tumblr, Twitter, even Google results. We're talking about them, the kind of campaign to make Google block porn and block child porn. Who knows, where that line rides, and it depends on different newspapers. But are we not going to have, are these companies not going to have to decide at some point whether or not they are platforms or whether or not they are publishers? And they are responsible in the same way that that we would be responsible for anything we put in the New Statesman.
I think it's even harder than that, because some of them have decided their platforms. Kickstarter is pretty clear that they're a shop. They don't exercise editorial control. What they might have to do is try and replicate what you have with telephone calls and the post. Royal Mail has, I can't remember what the actual name of it, I think it's sort of Common Carrier or something, legal exemptions, which basically mean that provided they don't open post, they cannot be held liable for things which are posted. Maybe that, maybe what we need is something, not just a legal recognition, but a cultural recognition, that some of these sites want to be common carriers. And actually Kickstarter, for instance, can be allowed to host anything, provided it doesn't stop anything. But, no one is saying that the internet is not free enough. This is not.
Well, some people on Reddit, I think,
some people on Reddit are. But if you had to look at whether there was too much horrible shit on the internet or not enough, it's pretty clear which way that's going.
Okay, and on that undeniable truth, Alex Hearn, thank you very much.
Thank you, Helen.
Today's podcast was presented by me, Geoffrey Lewis, with Geoffrey Bear, Geoffrey Eaton, Geoffrey Foxton, Geoffrey Hearn, Geoffrey Elmhurst, Geoffrey Mossman, Geoffrey Trilling, and Geoffrey Waite. It was produced by Geoffrey Crampton, edited by Geoffrey Morn, and our theme music is taken with Devil with the Devil with the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. We'll be back next week, and you can find us at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.